What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today the Baron's downfall is hastened by spice. I'm your host, Humphrey Shu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone. And today we will be covering the second half of Chapter 47 of Dune. So, you know, every week we're inching closer. Next episode will be the last chapter, which is, albeit it's very long, but that's just so exciting. And you know, this second half of the chapter is, I believe, much more exciting than the first half, which was more political maneuvering. This is where everything really goes down. So really cool stuff. But before we dive into the chapter, I want to hear from y'all. So anything new that y'all want to update us on? Anything fun?
Well, my squad a crawfish boil yesterday.
Oh, yum, I guess.
Yeah. It was our annual crawfish boil, and I went to help out, and now my shoes smell of crawfish. Like, the water, it kept draining my shoes. Oh, wow. And now it's like, I was going to spend the next week, like, drying and, like, rinsing it and, like, re-cleaning it.
Yeah.
It would be so nasty, but it was fun while it lasted.
Wow. I haven't had crawfish in a while. My parents have asked me twice in the last, like, month whether I want to have crawfish. Every time, like, too much effort.
That's so much like true, though. Like,
yeah, I do.
Not really.
I think it's nice, but I don't know. Recently, I haven't been feeling it. I feel like it's like a really like mood-based food. It's just, oh, I'm feeling crawfish, so get crawfish.
I'm just lazy, okay? Like, yeah, I just don't want
to
peel.
You have to peel it all, and then it like gets everywhere.
It's just too little for the amount. It's just too little for the amount of work you have to do.
It's mainly about the taste. Like some of like the flavor, like the sauce is like good, and then you know you can like I guess like I don't know, it's like sauce or like juice or something, right? I
mean, isn't it like a mini lobster basically?
Yeah. And then basically, like, you can get like potatoes and like dip it in, you know, and those are like
corn as well.
Corn.
They like boil them all in that pot with like all the spices and whatnot.
Yeah. And like,
but like after, it's so concentrated, it's kind of nasty after like a couple hours. It's like, it's like whoa.
And then they keep boiling more stuff in it. They just reuse the same like soup, and it's kind of gross.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, it's definitely not that clean. But
I mean,
it's just basically something you need. It's like a craving, so for a lot of people. I mean, I remember. Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, eating crawfish is
I'm
like
sure
a skill.
They'll have it at Duke, so it's not my last year.
Not my last
crawfish boil, I'm sure.
Yeah, I bet they have a lot of good food at Duke. I heard good things about the dining halls, so. Really
You're going to say yours, Humphrey? Hold up.
Wait, my what?
It was.
We're gonna reveal our college. Like,
no, we can do that now. I mean, or we could wait for that.
I'm still technically waiting on one of mine. But
which school are you waiting for still?
Rice.
Oh yeah, for the
waitlist. The wait list.
I've decided not to take any.
They just hate people from where I'm from, so
from Houston, dude, like you can't get into
it's anywhere. Kind of what happened.
It's just you know, they're like too many Houstonians applying and they just don't like that.
One of their hardest majors just on a whim, and then I somehow I'm surprised I even got waitlisted, to be honest.
Yeah, but I mean, both of you have decided your colleges, so it's just really waiting for me. But I'll be deciding in a few weeks. So by that time, I'll do the big reveal.
All right.
Or it might be a small reveal, depends on which way I go. But
it's fine.
Yeah. So, anyways, So pretty long intro discussion, much longer than usual, but pretty fun. So, Fillmore, why don't you take it away with the quotes?
Okay. So my quote this week is, "We cannot know how it will go." And the taller companion, hand restored to eye, added in a cold voice, "But this Muad'Dib cannot know either."
Wow.
It's pretty intense, I would say.
How the turntables, right? My quote goes, my quote goes, "I'm sorry, grandfather," Aaliyah said. "You've met the Atreides Gondabar."
Wow, he got the short end of the stick.
Yeah, it's real snarky. You know, this Aaliyah got a little sting in her words.
Pretty sassy.
My quote goes, "Save yourself, sire," a Sardaukar officer shouted. "Into the ship."
Into the ship, everybody. Into the
Get
ship.
Get to the chopper.
Isn't it, it? Yeah, it was. I was just thinking of that scene from the movie, right? It was just where
the Predator.
From the movie.
Dune?
The Dune movie. Yeah, where Paul was like getting off on the spice, and then I think it was Gurney who had to go out and get him.
I mean, that scene never actually happened in the book.
Yeah, but I mean, it was like a pretty epic movie scene. I mean, cinematography was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't really mind the change.
I didn't really mind a lot of changes in there. Yeah. I
mean, yeah, it was relatively accurate.
Yeah, so. But make sure to check out episode 50 if you want to hear more about that.
Episode.
Yeah, our special. That was our first and only special. We need
almost
to find some
2 hours long.
Yeah, we need to find some more specials to do. Sometimes we just like gotta talk about life or
we
something.
Should.
Yeah.
Yeah, send us some questions, guys. We might do a Q&A.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. But anyways, so let's dive right into the bulk of the chapter then. So we start again at a mini climax of this chapter 47. The Baron is silenced by a raging emperor, and later he'll be silenced by something else. But some quotes to put this chapter into perspective. You know, the emperor just goes, "Do not abuse my intelligence any longer." And another one is just, "You say you don't know about the activity we found, nor the fighting qualities of these superb people." The emperor lifted himself half off his throne. "What do you take me for, Baron?" So the emperor is just fully unleashing his rage under the Baron. You know, it's like a screaming, one-sided screaming match. But the Baron actually didn't know any of this. He was actually clueless. So
he's that gamer rage.
You know, Lita reminds me of this, you know, a five-year-old that gets killed in some, you know, Call of Duty or something.
Yeah, he takes an L and he just instantly starts cussing out him out.
That's basically the emperor.
Spawn killed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so something that occurred to me is that the Baron is technically Leto's father-in-law, or not? That's not really correct. So maybe his father in relation. So this vendetta between the Harkonnens and the Atreides is, well, technically a family feud now, and unfortunately, it's not the television show.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, like, this is the most interesting development between the Emperor and the Baron. The Emperor really just suspects the Baron has been almost lying to him the entire time about the information that he knew on Arrakis. But the thing is, like, he's absolutely furious about it. I'm just most confused on the fact, like, why exactly is the Emperor super mad about this? Like, is it simply because he thought the Baron was taking advantage of the Imperium's elite forces to fight the Fremen? And then, like, just, I don't know, maybe he was hoping that, like, they tired the Sardaukar out, and that's why he's mad? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, the Emperor probably just hates things being hidden from him. I mean, who was it that mentioned something about training the Fremen to become a fighting force? I mean, I know Leto mentioned it with Desert Power, but I could have sworn Hawat mentioned it too when he was consulting with the Baron.
Yeah, and do you also remember that time when the Baron mentioned to Fenring about making Arrakis a prison planet? So I think that was another moment where weaponizing the Fremen was brought up. So although, I mean, it was by accident, but still, it was like a moment where
it was a big fear,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, it's just, I mean, there's just so many things going on here, but I mean, I love again how cool Aaliyah is all about all of this, even under, you know, all these different circumstances. Because I know for a fact that when I was like 3 years old, I didn't even know how to count, let alone do all this stuff that Aaliyah's doing. But I mean, then again, she's also supernatural. And this is her kind of really cool quote. She goes, "Make him afraid some more, Shaddam. I should enjoy this, but I find the pleasure impossible to suppress." So, I mean, it's just, ooh, you know, she actually uses the first name of the Emperor. What a legend.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Aaliyah's almost like the materialization of what I aspire to be, just like me fully unhinged, just letting everyone, no matter who they are, hear all my intrusive thoughts. It's just like, almost like it feels so limiting to just hold back, knowing that you must maintain this like fake image for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I think if most people let out all their intrusive thoughts, there would be a lot of people in jail.
For real.
That's so true.
Yeah, I mean, we don't need more people in jail. I mean, tax dollars. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, and Aaliyah just continues by naming herself and naming her intentions, and this is just really, you know, cool. It's definitely not something you'd expect from someone like her. It's just so like grand, kind of like what a king would say, or like a leader on the battlefield. You know, it's just, "I am Aaliyah, daughter of Duke Leto and the Lady Jessica, sister of Duke Paul Muad'Dib. My brother has promised to have your head atop his battle standard, and I think he shall. It's just so confident, and it must be a crazy shock to the Baron to have a 3-year-old or whatever year old talking to him like this. I mean, Aaliyah doesn't even obey the Emperor when he tells her to be quiet. She is a menace, you know. She is.
Yeah, Aaliyah's on some demon time for real. Like, she got that Black Air Force energy.
Yeah.
But in all seriousness, I think she deserves to talk down on the Emperor. I mean, he was the cause behind her ending up like that because, well, Jessica never would have gone through the Reverend Mother right if House Atreides didn't fall. And, well, in this way. And not to mention, he's technically her relative. I mean, I remember, the Duke and the Emperor are cousins, so technically they're related, maybe twice removed or whatever, but they're still, like, relatives. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so weird because like right now like Aaliyah, like both of the people in the room are basically like some weird uncle type of people to her. Like, it's just so strange. She's like, all this is one big family and it's all coming back in a full circle. Mm-hmm. Such strange things, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the funniest part is just like how she tries to like make this more than just a family issue. She like looks at the Reverend Mother and just like drags her into this entire conflict, going like, she knows. And like, it's so funny because like we see that the complete breakdown of like supposedly the most powerful Bene Gesserit that the Emperor knows and the Baron knows, to someone who's usually so composed to the point of complete control over her own faculties. But now because like Aaliyah is now screaming for unspeakably painful death upon Aaliyah and her mother in front of these people, in front of the Emperor, in front of the Baron, who've never seen her like this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it's just so like crazy because this Reverend Mother Mohiam, she's, you know, she was the one who was intimidating Paul and Jessica, and you know, she was just, you know, I remember the weirdest thing that Jessica ever saw her do was shed a tear, right? And now she's just here and she's just like she's you know, basically balding with all the stress. She's molding with Aaliyah putting so much pressure on her. So mm-hmm.
I think it's so weird because I mean, in the beginning of the book, she had a somewhat like almost daughter mother relationship with Jessica, and now she's just called asking for her death, and it's just, I don't know. Look at how much people change over time.
Yeah,
she can't handle the grand dollar.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Aaliyah is added to the cache of Reverend Mothers that Gaius Hellemohiam has in her mind. And the way that the Reverend Mother talks here, it's like that meme, get out of my head, get out of my head, you know, that meme. And I want to read this chunk that the Reverend Mother says, which really, you know, shows what she thinks. And she doesn't sugarcoat her words. "That child is an abomination," the old woman said. "Her mother deserves a punishment greater than anything in history. Death. It cannot come too quickly for that child or for the one responder." The old woman pointed a finger at Aaliyah. "Get out of my mind." So the Emperor doesn't understand any of this because he's not of the Bene Gesserit way. But the Reverend Mother is bent on having Aaliyah killed. She's just, you know, now she's, that's her sole focus in life. Suddenly, you just, mm-hmm. I need this.
It's
I
her
need
number this, one task.
I need this little kid murdered for real, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's really funny though, because like the Emperor's confusion is super weird because he's like, TP? And then like, when I first read this, I was kind of shocked because like, I mean, I kind of suspected what it meant like right away after in the context, right? But I didn't realize that the abbreviation for telepathy was like commonly used during Herbert's lifetime. I was like, TP, like I only saw that video game, like telepathy, you know? It's very slang and like, it's really unexpected for the abbreviation to slip into like the Emperor's own diction. Like, I did not expect slang words to come out of this Emperor's mouth. It's like, TP? I was like, TP? I was like, ET? I was like, what?
I was also confused at first because, well, the only thing that came to mind when I saw TP was toilet paper, and the second thing that showed up in my head was also teleportation. And, well, that doesn't really fit the context, does it? So, and also, I would have expected someone of such high pedigree to not use slang. Like, I guess who knows? This is technically in the future. So, well, at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if the Emperor started rapping for some reason.
It literally becomes Eminem. That's so true. Yeah, it's just TP, 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 yeah.
No, isn't there like a rapper named like T-Pang or something like that?
Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
Well, I mean, anything is a rap name nowadays. Just throw Lil in front of it and you're good, you know?
That's so true.
Lil Shaddam.
So for
Lil Shaddam. Oh, bro needs to immediately start.
Yeah. I'm Big N, supposedly. That's what some people call me.
Oh yeah, like Biggie Cheese, stuff like that.
Wait, I didn't know that. That's even worse. I mean, at least Lil is, you know, a little, it rolls off the tongue a bit. Biggie, really?
Yeah, I mean it was a famous rapper, I think.
Well,
back to the book, away from rapping and stuff, but the Reverend Mother, right? Let's talk about why exactly do I believe the Reverend Mother gets so worked up to prevent a birth like Aaliyah's from ever happening. Like, it's like the Bene Gesserit's entire goal, like to prevent like this weird abomination of Aaliyah. But I don't really understand why. Is it because like they cannot handle the idea of multiple Reverend Mothers who coexist and who feel connected to the past? Or is it because like Aaliyah isn't exactly just like any other Reverend Mother? She's got like some type of advantage over Gaius, Helen Mohiam, and Jessica, right? That lies beyond their reach almost. Because it's like Paul's ability surpass all understanding similar to that. And I'm not quite sure. Especially since it's like hinted in the chapter's epigraph that Aaliyah was able to access stuff that was like unknowable because of him, through him, right? Whatever it is, like Aaliyah throws the blame of like being weird right back at the Reverend Mother. She's like, I'm not weird, you're weird. She's like calling her out for playing the role that led Jessica down this path.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps Aaliyah has some power we don't know of, something that's a direct result of her unnaturalness. But somehow she seems to be able to overwhelm the Reverend Mother at a whim. Or perhaps the Reverend Mother just wasn't prepared for Aaliyah to be in her head, forcing her to understand what happened to her. It's just imagine suddenly all these thoughts being forced onto you. I guess that's kind of what happened with the embryo Aaliyah too, right? All these thoughts being forced onto her. And as Aaliyah says, you don't know how it was, yet you rattle on like a purblind fool.
Yeah, I was just wondering, it kind of reminded me of when Paul, like, pulsed at Jessica, like, sent her, like, his thoughts and feelings. It's like,
oh yeah,
maybe that's what Aaliyah could do as well.
Last chapter, he said women were able to give and men were able to take. And, right? That's, like, the roles in the Bene Gesserit. Yeah, and that's why they didn't have male Bene Gesserits, because they would overpower and kill themselves during the process.
Yeah,
something like that. Yeah,
either way, it's a strange situation, because I thought they worked hard to prevent a birth like this, because it was dangerous for the child, but it looks
that's
like
too
there
nice
were
for the Bene Gesserit.
We don't know that though, because it still looks like there are other intentions behind it. So perhaps this child goes against their values of being human, because in a way, maybe Aaliyah is too human, because she has the experience as a multiple Bene Gesserit. However, I don't really see how being too human goes against what they stand for, so I'm just gonna guess and say that it's because they don't want a powerful anomaly like Aaliyah spawning. And I mean, if she spawns, she's just gonna go against them, because she knows like all the bad secrets and whatnot.
Yeah, and she can
probably
really
destroys their
that
power structure.
Yeah, it's just there's not supposed to be everything. She's unnatural, she's not supposed to be a River Mother, you know.
She's the outlier.
Yeah,
their perfect plan comes like crumbling down whenever any like overpowered anomaly like Paul or Aaliyah shows up in their universe.
Yeah, that just really is how the Bene Gesserit operate.
Because they're like politicians, they're like behind the scenes shadow puppeteers, and you can't masterfully manipulate the universe if someone is just gonna like destroy you at your own game. So that's how it is. But also, like, similar to the Emperor himself, I'm also quite curious on how much communication Aaliyah really has with Paul and with, like, the rest of her family, right? Because what we do know from last chapter is that Paul can tell that Aaliyah was still alive because he kind of felt or kind of saw her spark still, like, existing, right? Still throbbing or whatever. And then the Emperor, like, when he asks if Aaliyah has the ability to ask Paul to surrender for her life, she doesn't outright say no. She doesn't really deny it. Rather, she redirects and says that I shall not do that. But if she really does have that permanent built-in connection to the level where she can like communicate direct words and emotions and like meanings to Paul, that'd be kind of a little overpowered, you know? But I don't really think that's real, because if that was possible, then like if it was as reliable as the Emperor thinks it is, then like Paul wouldn't have heard about the Imperium raid from like a messenger. He would have heard it directly from Aaliyah herself.
Right. I mean, everything that's being spoken here, Paul would get wind of, which doesn't really make sense, as you said, because then there wouldn't really be much of a story, right? And there would have been a lot more, you know, Paul would have known more, right? And I just think that Aaliyah is just bluffing a lot here, if I'm being honest, you know. And
that's so true.
I'm using the word bluffing because I recently started getting into poker and everything. But I mean, so I mean, she knows that she has no other leverage. So she just has to make some power plays. She knows that she's in this stuck situation where she's kind of a lot, you know, kind of biding her time. She knows that Paul is going to attack, but I mean, but she just kind of biding her time and prolonging all of this suffering that the Baron has to go through.
Well, I was thinking that Aaliyah was just assuming that Paul's power of prescience would guide him to her and was sort of betting on that. Well, she was also betting on the quick spread of information for him to come get her. But I mean, she's just like running all these different variables in her heads, hoping like that Paul gets to her as soon as possible and sort of buying time while just saying, oh, Paul's going to kick your butt whenever he gets here. It's like a little kid saying, oh, my daddy's better than yours, and he's going to kick your butt if you keep bullying me. Stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that really is kind of, I mean, because Aaliyah herself, I mean, she has power, don't get me wrong, but, you know, Paul has more power. And the only way that, yeah, the overwhelm is with Paul's power.
Mm-hmm. And Aaliyah's not still really physically developed. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, yeah, she's smart. I'm sure she moves fast as well. And she's definitely good enough to lead attacking groups against the Sardaukar. But, like, she only can do so much as a three-year-old. Even Paul can only do so much when he was younger. Like, he needed to, like, develop his skills a bit more, even though, he, of course, both of them are naturally talented.
Right.
So, yeah. And it was just, like, for a family that really doesn't, like, believe in religion themselves, all of them, like Aaliyah, Jessica, and Paul, sure did play that religion card. Like, they played up their religious affiliation to the best of their abilities to really strike fear into the hearts of their opponents. And here, like, obviously, Aaliyah is trying to buy time, and like, she's making it sound like the mandate of heaven is like for Paul to win against the emperor. And to do this, the emperor no longer, like, he's just like, she's just trying to like force him to fold early, really. He's trying to like force him out of the game. Like, he's trying to force the emperor to no longer remain confident in his own position. Mm-hmm. That like he must scream to retreat, like to get back to space, because he needs to reconsider landing again. But also, like, he's like, dump her outside in the storm, because he just does not want to hold on to her any longer because of how much
she knows and how much of a problem she poses. And I mean,
she's like a threat to like everyone around him, like to his reverend mother, who's his wisest counsel. She doesn't respect him. Like, she's just talking back, and like, he doesn't want to kill her, or else he just loses her bargaining chip. But still,
I mean, so many poker analogies today. But I mean, again, more bluffs. We're just instilling fear in the emperor and his troops about Paul, and, you know, really the extent of his strength. And also the timing is a little too convenient, because right after Aaliyah proclaims the strength of Paul, he just breaks through, you know, just comes and wipes out everything. So, wow, I mean.
Yeah, talk about perfect timing. I mean, it low-key would have been the perfect place to end the chapter and leave us on a cliffhanger. But I'm glad that Herbert decided against
them. Yeah, so we can actually cover that in this chapter.
Yeah, so one thing that I wanted to note before moving on to the most exciting part of the chapter is the fact that, like, there's an interesting socio-political status mentioned about the Sardaukar. So Herbert actually refers to them as House Sardaukar in this chapter. So just wondering, like, I mean, I know there's like the great houses, of course. So I interpret the houses in the Dune universe as kind of like races of different planets, as like in ours, right? It's like Earth people or like Martians or whatever. So if House Sardaukar, like if they are a house, do I mean that there's like minor houses as well? Or do you also think that they're part of like the great houses?
I mean, I bet it's a fabrication of the Emperor. So, I mean, it's kind of like one to maybe intimidate others by making a Sardaukar great house, or maybe lend more credibility to a Sardaukar by making them a house, even though they're not truly a house. The second reason I kind of have is that the Sardaukar are put into a house to maybe encourage them by making more of a sense of solidarity and loyalty, right? And maybe even as a reward, just be like, oh, if you perform well enough, you'll be added to House Sardaukar, which sounds a lot more royal than just you're going to become a Sardaukar brute, right? I mean, that just sounds a lot more like these Sardaukar have something to work for. And I mean, I doubt that these guys, the House Sardaukar, I doubt that it's legitimately recognized, given that everyone's so afraid of them, you know.
I mean, it could be the opposite, where they're only recognized because they're so feared, and well, they also have the emperor backing them. But I guess in terms of reputation, they'll never have the same prestige as a real house. I mean, imagine the house starter car being compared to the house Atreides or even the house Harkonnens for their brutality. Like, they kind of fall short when it comes to like certain aspects of a real house.
Yeah, I'm sure that many of the other houses only think of House Sardaukar as like a minion of the Emperor, and that they're only in the, like, if they are in the Lanzerat's Great Houses convention, and they're only there as like a spy for the Emperor and as like a voter for the Emperor's opinions.
Right. I mean, and continuing from that, the Emperor even apologizes to the Baron here. So I never thought that the Emperor would lay himself down low enough, but, you know, the Baron is not going to live for much longer. So he's never going to be able to brag about, oh, the Emperor apologized to me. But so basically this, the Emperor's intent on killing Aaliyah and doesn't intend her to be a hostage. So that's the first thing that we already kind of talked about. And then here's my quote for the week, which is kind of an anti-climax to the chapter. It's just something that doesn't really, you know, it's not satisfying. And it goes, "I'm sorry, grandfather," Aaliyah said, "you've met the Atreides Gom Jabbar." So
yeah, it's almost like he won a prize. Like, oh, yeah, you won $1 million.
Yeah, you won $1 million and a piece of this poison. Congratulations. Yeah. So, I mean, more like Aaliyah's won $1 million because Aaliyah just, you know, took out the Baron. And
she just ended the vendetta.
Yeah, and so here's what happened. When Aaliyah backs into the Baron, she stabs him with the Gom Jabbar. You know, the Baron at this point, I mean, Aaliyah really reads the situation perfectly because the Baron at this point is trying to recover, kind of salvage the remains of his relationship with the Emperor. And since the Emperor ordered Aaliyah to be killed, the Baron is trying to kill her and kind of show his allegiance, right? But I mean, what I love about this is that she presents her family ties here. Grandfather, you know, like, yeah, you're my grandpa, but you didn't know, and you tried to kill all your descendants in cold blood, and now you can just go die, right? And you know, it's just crazy. Shocked. Just imagine, yeah, he was probably so shocked he couldn't even process anything else, because, you know, who knew that the concubine of his worst enemy, and currently his worst enemy, are direct descendants of him. You know, it's just, wow.
And like, he had that love story back then, but like, he doesn't want to remember that love story.
Yeah, all these family ties, right? I mean, I just think that's kind of crazy. But I mean, why I call this thing an anticlimax is it's, again, a really ridiculous death for someone of the Baron's importance. So all these important people have been dying really kind of flimsy deaths. It's just, there's no drama to it. There's no, like, you know, anything. The Baron just kind of gets stabbed, sees the blood on his palm, and just sags into suspensors, right? And I mean, this imposing, intimidating figure, just remember in the Baron in the movie, he rose to, I don't know, like 15 feet tall, right? And just this intimidating figure, just, yeah, one slice on the wrist or on the palm, and then he's done for. And I mean, there's nothing, you know, it's just more of Herbert's style to just murder and move on to a different scene. So, I mean, I just think it's crazy. This guy who's been mortal enemies of Paul and the Atreides for the whole book is just reduced to ashes in a few sentences. And I mean, what's also interesting here is how Aaliyah managed to conceal the poison. It's almost like she knew it would play out in such a way that she'd get to the Baron and be free to kill him. Somehow she came prepared with that. And I mean, I'm kind of doubting her assertion earlier that she only allowed herself to be captured because she didn't want to relay the bad news. Maybe she allowed herself to be captured because she knew that she'd be in the presence of people that she could assassinate. And and I mean, Aaliyah stole Paul's kill here, you know, I mean, bad team plays. Yeah. So yeah, Paul deserved the kill. I mean,
she's an egoist.
Yeah. Paul deserved the kill because the Baron has done a lot worse to his family than to Aaliyah, because Aaliyah's not that old. Right. But
Well, I mean, considering that the Baron's plot armor allowed him to live this long, well, I would say it was a pretty good run for him. Also, I guess it's somewhat fitting that Aaliyah finished the job with the poison with the Gom Jabbar, because, well, the story started with it. It started with the Gom Jabbar test with Paul, and now it ends with the Gom Jabbar test with Aaliyah. So sort of comes full circle there. But honestly, though, Herbert could have made his death a bit more grandiose since, well, he was one of the main villains. So, yeah, he kind of needed a better death. He kind of died a dog's death. But I guess it's more realistic that he dies this way. Although, yeah, it is somewhat disappointing.
Basically, like, he gets stabbed and, like, hear, like, Baron's, like, screaming. But, like, all the ensuing chaos is about to happen kind of takes away from the moment of his death, because we know that the Gamcha boy doesn't kill you right away. Like, it's painful, it's like writhing, and like we just did not get to see the expression of the Baron because there's so much more going on.
Yeah,
right. And just like that was just so nonchalant, like, oh, he's alive and now he's dead.
Bye bye. Yeah, yep. Next. Yeah.
Yeah, so basically what's about to happen is like Armageddon in the book as the battle begins. Like, everything's roaring, everything's trembling, everything's like rocking about. There's lightning balls zigging around, shields fraying outside. It's just massive chaos as everything comes, like, just it's... like all the world is like moving, you know?
Yeah, it's just like that scene from the movie where was it Gurney who was flying that ship through the sack of Arakin, Idaho, and it was just all the lasers. Sometimes I have to go watch that scene again because it was just so epic, right? And I mean, man, that just kind of reminds me of that, except for this one's a lot more dust and sand.
They're probably like choking all this dust stirred up.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have time to choke, you just get shredded.
To asthma person's worst nightmare.
Well, I think non-asthmatic people will also quite literally be coughing up dust.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, there's even like this more hilarious foreshadowing of imminent doom in basically my quote of the week that I chose, which goes right here. "Save yourself, sire," a Sardaukar car officer shouted, "into the ship." Like, it's just such a classic line that you hear from like these naval shows, and like it's just such a funny thing, you know? But like, the naval parallels in the book Dune just reminds me of the saying, like, the captain goes down with the ship. So, you know, even though the Emperor's going to his little safety bunker inside the ship, it's not gonna be enough. He's probably gonna stayed, like, because they sunk the ship, basically, because they knocked off their nose, so they can't never like leave the Arrakis. I'm sure he's gonna, like, this is like a foreshadowing of like his imminent death, and he really isn't gonna make it out alive, you know? Like, all the literary devices are working against him, so beat that, Emperor, the plot is against you now.
Yeah, and I mean the Baron's just already dead, so I mean, I wouldn't put it past Herbert to just, you know, nonchalantly kill Shaddam IV here too.
Double kill.
I mean, even Aaliyah is seeking out knives to kill injured Sardaukar Harkonnen. She's like 2 years old. Who knows? There's other agents here. And I mean, what physical strength for a youngin, you know? I don't know. I still don't know how to use a knife. Yeah.
I just noticed that your age for Aaliyah is getting lower and lower each time.
Yeah, first, I know. It was 3 years
old, and now it's 2.
Yeah, that's
I just thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, that's on purpose, by the way.
Well, you're like Beethoven underplaying her age in order to seem more impressive.
Yeah, I mean, that's on purpose, by the way. I learned that from some comedy, I remember.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, her real age is actually 4 years old.
Oh,
okay. Oh, really? Okay, well, you mean 1-year-old? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, actually, she's still in the womb, and she's destroying everybody.
Yeah, with her mind, she's out here destroying women.
It's her after image.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, one thing I want to point out is that, most intriguingly, even though the world is coming to an end around them, there's some people that are still quite calm, you know? The Emperor retreats into his little chamber inside the ship, and he sees Princess Irulan physically, like, exerting breath, you know? Like, she's, like, tired, and she's, like, running and, like, freaking out, of course. But who's not freaking out are the two guildsmen that had accompanied them down to Arrakis. So the guildsmen seem kind of oblivious to the ensuing losing battle that they're stuck in. If I remember correctly, the guildsmen's faces were never, ever seen and never described before. But now we kind of get, like, a quick sneak peek into, like, a glimpse of their ultra-dark blue eyes. So, like, the eyes are described as so dark that, like, it seemed almost black. And the only blue eyes that I knew, like, when I first read this, I was like, whoa, blue eyes? Are they Fremen? Are they, like, cousins or, like, far-off relatives? You know, like, maybe, like, they're, like, a, you know, like, they their descendants split up a long time ago. One of them came to Arrakis, one of them stayed in space. I don't know. But it was just, like, it must have something to do with spice, because the Fremen's eyes are Ibad, right? So they're, like, similar in that way. And I'm sure that, like, I think that the guildsmen do consume spice for whatever, like, future seeking that they're doing. That's why they depend on the spice planet so much. But, like, there's some type of spice consumption going on. And there's, like, there must be some difference in the spice, some manipulation to the spice to change their eye color to such inky darkness. Like, something going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I mean, the Guildsmen are mercenaries to the core, right? I mean, of course, they're oblivious, I think, because they've never cared in the first place. I don't think they really have hearts. The Guildsmen remind me of heartless mechanical animals much more than anything else, right?
It's kind robotic.
Of, it's who the Bene Gesserit are warding against. But I mean, it's just, I feel like it's just that's because they're so mercenary that they believe that whoever wins, they win too. I mean, they feel like the real winner in war is the weapons merchant. In this case, it's a transporting merchant. I mean, they don't realize that they're one leg of a teetering tripod here.
Even if they need more than one leg to keep this tripod up. So they got to remember that they need another people.
The balance of power is precarious, and they really need to keep it in. Well, they just need to keep it still, or else everything's just going to fall apart. And talking about the eye color and it being really dark. So I think I remember the guild using spice for space travel, something about going in like a trance to like figure out where the locations of the planets are. Right. So I was wondering if staring into the abyss of space while consuming spice has to do with how dark their eyes are. I don't know. It just made sense to me when I was writing it, but yeah.
Maybe like just like
we'll never know, I guess.
It's so strange. It's like taking like enjoying spice while you're
like black blasting. Eyes that are practically they're like really dark black blue eyes. That's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just like they're absorbing the colors around them, you know, like they absorb, like for the Fremen, they absorb the blue sky. I mean, I'm assuming their sky is blue, but like they're absorbing the blue sky. And then for them, like they're absorbing the inky darkness of the universe while they try to peer ahead, you know?
Right.
Oh, no.
That's interesting. And well, anyways, so now we get to my quote for this week, and it goes, "We cannot know how it will go." And the taller companion, Henry Stortei, added in a cold voice, "But this Muad'Dib cannot know either." So little does this guy know that Paul can track them down to the end of the universe, and well, they really can't do anything about it. So I would definitely love to see how Paul uses his powers to finally be the hunter instead of being hunted.
Right. It's just definitely like so interesting because of the fact that these people, like their only way of like coping is just like, well, if we don't know, he doesn't know. It's like the what little kids tell themselves, like, if we can't see them, that means they can't see us, right?
Oh yeah, and if just, you like, can't see me, I can't see you or something.
Like, that's so dumb. Like, it's not like a inherently, you know, the logic doesn't work, because like if you're covering your own eyes or like if you're closing your eyes, that's your fault, you know? And like this is what they remind me, like they're supposed to be super wise people, like they're supposed to be super smart, and the Emperor's just like, what are they doing, you know? Like, because like they don't seem very smart right now in the context that they're given in. I don't know, it just doesn't feel as overwhelmingly smart as they appear off to be.
Right.
But yeah, here we basically like get to the end of the chapter, and we just like end off this chapter with the Emperor being like, gosh, I can't depend on these guildsmen to protect me. Like, they're looking off into space, thinking about like they're coping with their little, like, if he can't see me, like if I can't see them, they can't see me. So there's like the Emperor here is just like, I have to take things into my own hands. So he refuses to give in to his own despair. He believes that he might still have a chance at winning. And he realizes that defeat is inevitable, and he needs to get some help from no other third party. He needs to like hunker down and get ready with his own fighting force, with his own people he's trusted for years. And he needs to get ready to face the bitter end. He turns to the Reverend Muller, Gaius Hellemohium, and he's like, "Reverend Muller, we must devise a plan." And there he goes, making his own master plan. At the last seconds of his life.
It's just like, you know you're lost, but it's like, yeah, let's plan anyway.
Yeah.
He's a man with a plan, but he will fail and that will be the end of his clan.
It's really weird though, because his plan is like about treachery or something, and it involves Count Fenry. Like, I don't really understand where his plan is going, but apparently the Reverend Muller understood it when they had that look, you know, that special look between
maybe
them.
Maybe it has to do with Fade, because, well, Count Fenring is in on the plan with, I mean, Countess Fenring, right? Of just
to marry.
Well, not really marry Fade,
you're right. Just to have a child, like, right?
Yeah.
I still don't see the plan though. Like, it's not gonna be ready in time. Like, how are you gonna, like, even if the treachery was like gonna happen, like you gotta have the child first, you know? Like, it's not gonna happen within the next like couple minutes. And he only has a couple minutes, but maybe we'll see a little surprise.
I don't really see what he's gonna pull out of his butt to get out of this one.
Maybe he'll be like, Paul, your long lost cousin is pregnant with the new heir or something like that.
Oh, jeez. It's like really
awkward. Oh, you might be like, oh, I'll give you Irulan if you spare my life or something.
Hey, yo, what? Oh.
Well, I could kind of see it happening,
married off. I mean, I remember reading that in Beowulf or something.
Political marriage is a thing, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it could happen. Because, I mean, clearly Irulan has to make herself into Paul's life at some point. Irulan wrote about Paul a lot, right?
Depends on how interested Paul is in, you know, woman or universe, you know?
Universal women.
Mm-hmm. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, we'll see.
How tempted Paul is.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read to this part in chapter 48 that ends in, "Let them look closely at their new host," Paul thought. So doesn't give too much away, but tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at DoNotEnter, Reddit @DoNotEnter, and email us at DoNotEnter@gmail.com. That's DUNENOTENTER@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or I dare say, I can't.
Wait, Nolan, do you know how to say that word?
Can you pronounce it? I don't think I can.
Oh, nah, not today, guys.
Not today. Okay, yeah. We'll pass on it for now. Give us a review on iTunes and Spotify. So it only takes a few seconds of your time. Of course, go to our show. Click the only button that exists, which is the 5-star button. You know, leave a follow on Spotify. And also leave a nice comment too if you are so inclined. And the reasons for this are twofold. One, it helps get our podcast up the charts and get it out to a wider variety of listeners and Dune fans. And two, it lets us know that we're doing a good job and motivates us to keep creating content for you guys. So it would be very much appreciated. Otherwise, thank you very much, and we'll see you all back very soon.
See you guys.
Bye, guys.